Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
The piece that I have trouble making clear to people is that these paradigms are only as good as they are useful. It's not helpful to debate how right neoliberalism is. That's even a thing that were possible any more than democratic socialism. The test is of all of these things is how useful they are as a problem-solving matter. And it seems pretty unambiguously the case that given the ideas of democratic socialism have been around as long as neoliberalism has, if not longer, and you haven't seen any kind of uptake and nearly the scale that you would need in order to give them a kind of a demonstration project out of our economy, then it may be not a messaging problem.
Yesterday, Sagar and I aired the season finale of The Realignment, where we spoke with Richard Hanania, who argued that many of the premises that have driven the show for the past year and a half are completely mistaken. The core way of summing up what he believes is that he disagrees with the idea that you can use economic policy to drive a realignment of American politics. Originally, we're going to leave it at that. But something I really enjoyed doing this fall was airing my reboot bonus conversations that link back to my actual day-to-day work at the Lincoln Network. And as always, that's Lincoln Network, not Lincoln Project. So from now on, going into 2021, we're going to bring you these reboot bonus episodes 1 to 2 times per month. So for today's episode, I had the perfect chance to air the counterpart to our conversation with Richard by speaking of Jennifer Harris at the Hewlett Foundation, who's leading a $50 million initiative to develop a new intellectual paradigm and framework to replace the neoliberal consensus that's undergirded American politics since the late 1970s. Now, that's obviously a bit wonky, and it seems like everyone left, right, and center likes to throw around the term neoliberal as the catch-all word for describing everything they don't like in the world. But over the course of the conversation, we really get to the central point that the whole idea behind a paradigm or even a framework is that it provides a space for common ground that both political parties and people in office can use to approach the world. There's even strong evidence that something driving the high levels of partisanship and the inability to do basic things such as pass a stimulus bill during a terrible COVID-19 recession in winter is the lack of a shared framework. To get a good idea of how these intellectual paradigms and frameworks work and why they're actually important, think back to the Clinton years. You had a moment where, on the one hand, culture war issues still mattered. President Clinton was getting impeached by Newt Gingrich and the Republican Congress. There were constant scandals. Yet at the same time, in the weeks before and after those very same impeachment charges, both parties worked together to reduce the size of government, to promote free trade, to let China into the WTO, even reform entitlement programs, the supposed third rail of American politics. Now, that's not to say that any of those ideas are correct, and I definitely don't think that Jennifer would endorse many of them. But the key thing, though, was because both parties had a shared framework, the idea that markets inherently work, the idea that government had certain priorities, especially during the height of the 1990s technology boom, it made it so that you could have the culture war battles, yet still get things done. So what we're trying to do in this episode is come up with ways and set the ground for finding new areas of consensus where you can actually pursue opportunities, such as, for example, the fact that on a bipartisan level, almost everyone in the United States agrees with the idea that we need some form of industrial policy to make it so that during a COVID-19 pandemic, we have the ability to manufacture vital medical supplies in our own country. We also could look to the example of the rapid deployment and the rapid development of the COVID-19 vaccine as a key example of how if there's a shared objective and an achievable moonshot, you can get a lot done in a very short period of time. So Jennifer's got the perfect background for discussing this. She's a Truman and a Rhodes scholar who worked in the Obama State Department. And she also co-authored a really important book called War by Other Means, Geoeconomics and Statecraft. A book that anticipated the debates and the central features of the Trump administration's trade war with China. As in, it wasn't simply focused on, opening up American markets to China. It was also focused on the impact that trade policy had on the domestic side of things. Now, I'm sure anyone in the audience, left or right, is going to be a bit skeptical about Jennifer's project, considering that background. I ask her about this on the show, but the obvious question is, how could someone who went through what many would define as the traditional establishment, Yale Law School, the prestigious Rhodes Scholarship, working in the Obama administration at its height, how could such a person actually work to replace the status quo? Her answer is a pretty interesting one, which focuses on the fact that when she was in the State Department, whenever they were attempting to think through these issues, especially related to trade, her colleagues consistently lacked the ability to tie together what was happening domestically with these foreign policy debates around trade. In her telling, that lack of language, that lack of an ability to conceive of the tie between what's happening on a geopolitical level with what's happening domestically indicated that the consensus wasn't working. So it's a great conversation. I hope y'all enjoy it. It's the perfect counterpart to our Richard season finale, and it sums up what we're focused on in 2021, which is building a space and a platform where we can figure out what comes next in all the areas of the realignment's focus: politics, policy, business, tech, media, pretty much everything else under the sun. I can't wait to get back with you and Sagar in the new year. Last thing, definitely go and check out our realignment newsletter at therealignment.substack.com. Our last issue of the year is coming out this afternoon. Also, definitely rate us 5 stars if you haven't already. Let's dive in. Jen Harris, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start here. Jen, can you tell me a little more about the project that you're leading at the Hewitt Foundation?
Sure. probably more than you would ever want to know, since it's kind of the singular thing that's occupied most of my mind for the last couple of years. So we've been quietly scoping kind of whether there's a role for philanthropy to really bring about a new common sense on how the economy works, the aims it should serve, and from that, what the role of government should be in structuring the economy. And it's kind of jumping off a pretty specific history in the role that a handful of largely conservative foundations played 50, 60 years ago in bringing about the rise of the current common sense that we have, which is imperfectly termed neoliberalism. And it was actually, by philanthropic standards, not a ton of money, and arguably, in the caliber of success that they had with kind of the revolution that thinkers like Milton Friedman and Hayek and Frank Knight and others kind of brought about, it was arguably one of the most successful returns on a philanthropic investment ever. So I think the hope is that there's scope to do something similar if new turns in an old game, since of bringing about a successor to neoliberalism that works a little better on just the range of practical problems that society faces.
Yeah, of course. And this is where you're pointing out that neoliberalism isn't the greatest term in all times becomes important. If we're talking about Hayek, the conservative thinkers, libertarian ones, such as Milton Friedman, what differentiates neoliberalism from basically the evolution of conservatism over the latter half of the 20th century? Because a lot of our listeners would differentiate Milton Friedman's thinking from just straight up neoliberalism. So how do you think about that idea?
It's a fair question. And I think that, there's considerable kind of give in the joints on a lot of this stuff and, a matter of some debate, although I actually don't see that debate really taking place in any kind of fulsome way. And I think that's in some ways part of the opening is that, a lot of these ideas have grown stale, without the kind of provocation and debate to keep them, continually refined by testing that was part of the ingredient to their rise 40 odd years ago. I think for my part, a lot of the distinction between neoliberalism as against kind of more traditional strands of conservative thought is really around the kind of the almost at the level of tactics, the kind of the way that you had a kind of fusionist moment with things like the Powell memo enlisting the business sector into, you know, a political project, really, and then likewise activating elements of the U.S. like religion, sort of religious base, and largely Protestant, and eventually elements of Catholicism as well, into that political project is what kind of distinguishes neoliberalism for my part anyway, from kind of more traditional and conservative ideas. So I think a lot of, as that happened, I think you had a more activist set of impulses. So it's not just sort of true laissez-faire, it's sort of a set of affirmative decisions on shaping markets, even if it's by omission, that have the effect of upward redistribution of wealth.
So let's then define what we mean by neoliberalism. As I understand, the framing is basically the policy consensus, especially in economics, and the use of the state for the past 30 or 40 years. But how would you characterize that consensus?
Sure. Well, I think it starts with a couple of different propositions. One of them is that markets are efficient and that they're populated by kind of atomistic individuals, each pursuing their own self-interest in ways that leave really no meaningful scope for the work that cooperation might do in shaping human behavior, for example. Second, that, that liberty and equality are inherently in tension. That was a really important move that the neoliberals made, and kind of pitting those two as you know, naturally in tension, and then privileging liberty as the more important good. And I think from there, it quickly should follow that government's best role is to simply get out of the way. And from there, the kind of more prescriptive policy-minded elements like deregulation and tax cuts are pretty natural impulses.
Yeah, of course. So let's talk a little bit about your background, because I think it's particularly relevant when it comes to the task and the undertaking you focused on, which is, you know, law school, Rhodes Scholarship. In many ways, if we're to sort of sum that all up, you're the definition of someone, the Hillary Clinton State Department. If you're a skeptical listener, you say, wait, Jen, you've benefited from the neoliberal system. But by definition, that's sort of the class of folk that's done particularly well in the system. How does your background lead you to the point today where you're saying we should actually replace that system?
Marshall, you forgot the best part. I'm sitting here talking to you from my living room in San Francisco.
Oh, fair, yeah. So, no, what's add that, which is
where people I moved, you know, from Brooklyn.
And thank you for pointing that out, because that's the key detail here, which is you and I are both obviously on a career level succeeding in the COVID-19 economy, where it's Zoom. This is actually incredibly convenient. I don't have to travel to San Francisco. We could both be wearing sort of casual clothing as we're doing this. So, how does that background really tie into the project you're going into?
Sure. Well, I should say that you know, I spent the first half of my life in Southwest Oklahoma, where you know, I don't need to probably explain to your listenership the many ways in which that's hard to recognize in, you know, downtown San Francisco today. You know, I think in terms of my probably the piece of my background that was a happy accident, I think, in preparing me for even the work that I'm currently doing, was the 10 or 15 years that I spent doing foreign policy. First, a little bit in the intelligence community, and for the longest stretch in the State Department, where my brief was really to think about the economic dimensions of U.S. foreign policy. And, you know, what I saw in sort of thinking through, like, how to respond to things like aggression of Russia, or the Eurozone crisis, or kind of how the U.S. should respond to the Arab Spring. And I think what I would do left unattended with most of my time is just think about, you know, all the changes that China's rise should spell out for U.S. foreign policy apparatus. And it just became clear that the State Department and the kind of the interagency bureaucracy was deeply uncomfortable exercising economic tools for U.S. foreign policy interests, for a set of ends that were non-economic. You know, kind of trying to scratch at what was behind those impulses of, you know, friends at the Treasury Department and elsewhere, it just became clear that this was kind of an ideology doing the work, kind of explaining why we should be only having a conversation about trade purely for trade's sake. This was, you know, not a geopolitical cudgel that we were allowed to exercise if it was really a conversation more about pursuing U.S. strategic interests. Did not sit well with me. And I think in part it came from growing up next to the largest field artillery base in the country, a place called Fort Sill, where I come from a military background myself. And my father was activated after 9/11 and spent many years in the Navy Reserve. And so I, you know, kind of both growing up watching, you know, my friends send their parents and siblings away to the Gulf War, and myself with my father, instance, knew well what we ask of our men and women in uniform and our military families when we reach too quickly for military options to do our geopolitical bidding around the world. So it just did. It seemed like a double standard that had not been terribly thought through as to why these economic tools that could work just as well, and in many cases, I think better, to achieve the same ends were for some reason off limits when we were very comfortable putting kind of U.S. blood and treasure up to the task. And I think, you know, so after being mostly at the losing end of a bunch of bureaucratic battles, trying to
the
ask
key detail.
Imagine how quickly I lost friends inside the Obama administration. I kind of went to a think tank to, you know, lick my wounds in part and you know, write a book as cheap therapy. And I think what I really put my finger on was that this discomfort, it had not always been so. The U.S. for most of its history did not have this allergy to using economic tools for geopolitical purposes, which is what I gave the term geoeconomics to describe in the book, and that something changed. And that was really right around the 1970s that happened coterminously with the rise of neoliberal thought. And it was kind of part and parcel of the kind of the claim that markets ought not be subjugated to any interests, be they geopolitical or otherwise. And so, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but this basic discomfort with that proposition, I think what ended up being pretty good preparation to, you know, have a good set of questions to ask across the board about whether neoliberalism is still suited to, you know, solving society's practical problems, both in the foreign policy domain, but as well as in the domestic domain, which is what I've been focused on more in the past couple of years.
Yeah. So what I appreciate about both your personal story and the framework you're providing is it's very intersectional in the sense that we're talking about politics, we're also talking about foreign policy, domestic policy. I want to start here, though. Typically, when you have this conversation and any conversation about sort of the future of neoliberalism and our paradigms, it's sort of centered around neoliberalism failed in X, Y, and Z ways. Let's discuss that. But I want to start with, in what ways did neoliberalism succeed? Because the key point is we're talking in the 1970s, like you said, where you sort of see the separation. And it seems to me, as someone who wasn't alive during the 70s, when I read the history, the narrative goes as follows. American politics and British politics as well, too, were sort of stuck in the post-New Deal, post-World War II era, stagnation, real lack of faith in government, and neoliberalism is represented by first Margaret Thatcher, then Ronald Reagan, and then the Clinton Democratic Party, Third Way, etc., really brings back energy to a political system where New Deal liberalism had run out of steam. So how do you think about the political framework that the ideas came in, that the ideas entered the fray with?
Yeah, I don't know that that telling is wrong or that I would disagree with it anyway. You know, it's clear that things got better, you know, in a lot of respects, not every respect. And that's an important, you know, set of qualifications to have and conversation to have. But in the kind of the main highlights of the plot that you just described, you saw stagflation, you know, more or less resolve and interest rates come down. You saw kind of society tearing itself apart at the seams, you know, get better certainly by the 90s, which is kind of, you know, when I became politically conscious enough to sort of have a view of what was basically working or not. And I think, you know, you did have elements of, I think, of the right sort of conscript neoliberal ideas to use race as a political wedge to further set of largely partisan aims on the right. My reading, so I think is worth mentioning some color on why this wasn't better for everybody. But I think you're starting to see some of those mistakes that frankly were made as much, if not more, on by actors on the left, right themselves, correct themselves. So thinking about the 94 crime bill and the kind of what we've seen, kind of transpartisan, which a term I use deliberately is distinct from bipartisan, but transpartisan effort on criminal justice reform over the past 5-10 years. Begin to undo that. I think it's complicated, but directionally, it's fair to say that there was a lot about neoliberalism that seemed to suit the moment that it was operating in.
So this is where I get a little concerned that, and once again, we're dealing with imperfect phrases, but the conception of neoliberalism just becomes too big in the sense that, like, let's start with the crime bill, and then I also think you were referring to the racial issues with the with welfare reform and those broader debates. The themes that conservatives and more conservative Democrats were sort of harping on there would be themes that would be a thing during the 1960s, before anyone would talk about neoliberalism, or before Milton Friedman's ideas had really spread beyond the academy. So debates about, hey, there are rising crime rates, what do we do? Debates about, hey, we are a relatively individualistic society, even by, you know, Western standards, therefore we're less willing to support one another in a communitarian way with policies such as welfare. So how much of that is neoliberalism in a specific moment, and how much is that the general character of the U.S. Sort of when people say we're a naturally center-right country, that's the debate we're always going to have.
Yeah, so the question sort of, does it prove too much?
Exactly. So in the sense that, like, and I don't know enough about the crime bill or welfare reform to say, like, no, that's totally wrong. What I'm more saying is the fact that we were having those debates the result of neoliberalism, or is that just an endemic debate to America as it's constituted?
No, I'm willing to be embarrassed here, but I think I would want to plant my flag on the side of it being, at least in large part, neoliberalism doing the work. So compare, the kind of water that Nixon was swimming in and, the 70s, and this famous quip that we're all Keynesians now, right as he was flirting with introducing a kind of UBI bill, and that he was positioning as a moral imperative. He had, the 10 most famous economists at the time taking out a full page ad in the New York Times, calling it a moral imperative to end poverty because we had it within our grasp to do so. You know, that is a very different zeitgeist than the moment that allowed those same, whether you want to call them small C conservative or specifically neoliberal ideas, the kind of rugged individualism and kind of accountability, law and order, and each quite separate, probably like the kind of notions of liberty and individualism doing the work on welfare more. So it would take that as a use case for welfare reform. I don't think that those same notes would have landed with such force had they been attempted in the early 70s when Nixon was kind of, he wasn't saying that in like, gosh, look at my good fortune to have been born president into this moment. He was, kind of imagining himself sort of swimming against the grain, but his version of that was, UBI, which, in this moment in 2020 would look downright socialist, right? Just to give you a sense for, I think, the power that these intellectual frameworks can have. I think it's worth at least trying to see if we can come up with a new one on the view that you can't go after something with nothing.
And that's really helpful. Let's sort of fast forward to 2020. Obviously, we're having this conversation after Joe Biden has won the presidency. Also, after, to many degrees, President Trump in many ways, despite running in 2015, 2016 as this sort of aberration from the sort of modern Republican consensus, aka his opposition to Medicaid cuts, his opposition to Social Security reform as in terms of things that he used to push back against Jeb Bush. Yet at the same time, he governed as a conventional Republican. His major legislative and personal achievements were effectively tax reform, aka tax cuts for the wealthy, which is the definition of Republican neoliberalism, and then also deregulation. If you talk to any sort of DC-based Republican, your Chamber of Commerce type, how is this administration a success? They would say, we did the most deregulation we've done basically ever. So you have Joe Biden, basically, and he's definitely not a person who describes himself as neoliberal, but I would say he grew up within that neoliberal intellectual space. He's very comfortable with it. And then you have a Donald Trump who was governing effectively as a Republican neoliberal, despite racist, horrible things he said in personal respects. I'm looking at the actual results. So why does it make sense then to have a conversation about replacing neoliberalism, given the two trends I just gave?
Yeah, I mean, you don't get to necessarily pick all of your political moments, but I'm okay with this one being the one that we're trying this all out in part because I think Donald Trump has broken a lot of intellectual china, and he hasn't been especially generative in developing any kind of coherent alternative to the kind of intellectual mayhem, but there's a certain utility in the creative destruction that and the kind of just breaking of a lot of conventional wisdom, the space that allows. I think an area that I know decently well as one pretty strong example of this is trade. Mm-hmm. Right? I think there's a whole lot more that all sides agree on than they disagree on. And I think the traditional pro large business constituencies are kind of on their heels and understand that whatever takes root, it will be quite different. And it probably will involve looking at trade as much as a tax issue as anything else, take one example. I'm actually really heartened by, kind of following President Trump in the way that this effort is. And I think on the left, and I should say that it feels like when you look at 2020, when you look around for the leaders on the right who are most likely to inherit the mantle of the GOP, I think regardless of whether Trump runs again in some ways, all of them, to my eye, look pretty post-neoliberal. When you look at a Josh Hawley or a Tom Cotton or a Marco Rubio. And so, that's a good hand to have if you're me. On the other hand, I think that the fact that they may be eyeing the national stage could complicate prospects for, working together, kind of creative bedfellows, odd bedfellows inside of the next 4 years. I guess we'll find out. Certainly there's a lot, there's a lot that could be on the table, including, very early questions coming in the next 4 or 5, 6 months around how ambitious we want to be on public investment and as we think about what a recovery from COVID looks like. And then on the left, I just say a couple of things. One, Biden's presidency is coming on the heels of a pretty rowdy primary where you had leaders like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren really making pretty structural arguments about what's wrong in the economy. And, you know, they're more interested in talking about structural pathologies and remedying them than they are any particular policy prescription. And, you know, the fact that Elizabeth Warren had a plan for everything, in some ways, the kind of the through line for all of that was that, government is always shaping the economy. There is no such thing as a free market. The question is how, and, making clear the ways in which it has just been, one massive game of upward redistribution in a lot of different domains of policymaking. And even people like Pete Buttigieg, who, were pretty clearly trying to corner the moderate lane of the primary, were talking in explicitly ideological ways, sort of going after supply side economics and free market fundamentalism and neoliberalism by name as the rightful target that we should take aim at. I think there's just a lot of ferment across the spectrum on the left, and what better kind of salesman for that than someone who is kind of small C conservative by their nature, like President-elect Biden. So I think the question for him is whether, he's been invoking the mantle of FDR an awful lot. And to my mind, FDR's greatest legacy was not any particular piece of New Deal legislation so much as it was Keynesianism. I mean, in the broader sense, not just simply the kind of monetary policy sort of demand stimulus insights of Keynesianism, but in the broader claims about government's role in shaping markets. And it was that kind of cementing of Keynesianism as just the common sense about how we should go about policymaking that outlasted FDR and lent a predictive logic for a generation of policymaking that succeeded FDR after he left office. So I would hope that the instincts to reach for FDR that we seem to be seeing out of Biden's team extend to the level of being willing to take on some of these larger ideological arguments.
Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff to unpack there. So first, if I'm thinking about the debates that are open right now, I'm wondering, where does your project, and obviously the project's in its first stages, so I'm not expecting a direct answer, but where does your project start to come down on the big open versus closed debate? So for context, as I'm thinking about post-2016, post-Brexit, America, UK, West in general, the big debates we could say is there's the side that supports openness. That's the idea that immigration, high-skilled, low-skilled is largely a good thing. It's additive, not reductive. Trade, obviously there's tactical debates like the way that we're talking now, but the question of is a trade deficit inherently just a bad thing, which is basically the Trumpian position that's closed, versus a more open position that trade is largely a good thing and that we could redistribute things properly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you think of that open versus closed framework?
These are harder questions that I get on other podcasts.
Sorry.
No, it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
And I just want to clarify, it's not gotcha, because I think this is a super interesting project, yeah. But these seem to be the issues that aren't getting adjudicated the way you ideally would like them to. It's easy for us just to say, man, no one liked George W. Bush and the Obama years sort of piddled out and Trump was terrible, so let's move on. But even as we're moving on, and I very much want to move on personally, there are these deeper, like it's the iceberg idea, right? There's this deeper thing below the surface. And to me, it seems, yeah, we could agree that something isn't going great, but the open versus closed debate is going to go on beyond just the Trump moment.
Yeah. I think it's kind of overdetermined. I think there's a whole lot about, Trump's base and his electoral path that is real and had been ignored for far too long. And, I sort of have some of those scars because I was, at places like the State Department, very much taking a kind of more hawkish line to, you know, what our economic posture with China should look like, as one example. Should we be insisting on currency provisions in trade agreements, or is that just fighting yesterday's war, which is a thing I heard a lot as some examples. And you know, I met that resistance, and I think a lot of things have combined, certainly Trump included, to you know, finish the persuasion that I couldn't personally do. And so I think there's you know, a lot of that intellectual China has now been broken for the good. I think it's also the case that a whole lot of what's frankly like a set of white grievances are too easy to activate, and they probably always have been. And I think I think we need to put in the foreground of what it means to do political economy again, really take seriously questions of who are the we. When we say we have a set of democratic, small d democratic claims over our economy, we need to think through who we mean by the we. And I think, you know, the examples of the most generous kind of welfare states, like in Europe, none of them have been pulled off with a kind of two-party system that I know of. I think that's something that's real. And often, I think the most generous welfare states happen to coincide with some of the most restrictive immigration policies. And I think, you know, it's worth investigating whether there's a causal relationship there. And another level, I think that actually the prospects for getting federal legislation on immigration are actually reasonably good, helped by the GOP's outperformance with Latinos in the last election in 2020.
So that's quick thing. That's interesting, just because. And I'm actually just fascinated in how you approach the right, in the sense I know you work with Orrin Cass. So thinking about how you at a foundational level are approaching the right is interesting. From the way that Sagar and I have seen this debate go, it seems that the election results in terms of improved gains with persons of color actually goes against the idea that Republicans should support immigration reform, in the sense that if you talk to Republicans on the Hill, what they will tell you is, quote, Trump was almost a parody of how you wouldn't want a politician, not just a parody, he was a parody in many respects. Trump spoke to Hispanic voters in the exact opposite way that you'd recommend if you wanted to have increased gains. Yet the gains happened anyways. There was the child separation crisis. There are all these sort of issues. So the reaction on the Hill, at least, amongst folks in my cohort is we actually don't have to ever do immigration reform. And actually this shows that if we're aggressive on culture issues, if we focus on socialism as a big issue, that's the example of Florida, we don't have to do big reform. So the big question here is, how do you, and once again, I'm not expecting an answer because it's literally, and if you had an answer, I think you'd be doing far, far, far bigger things than just supporting people's works. But how do culture wars fit into the economic stuff we're talking about? Because I love the econ stuff. It's really helpful. But something that's been very depressing the past few months is to see a lot of this energy that was going towards things hypothetically like industrial policy, like a new economic consensus, was pushed towards COVID trutherism, was pushed towards, you know, the Republican National Convention this summer. It was nothing but grievance. Much of it, like arguably to your point, was like white identity politics. So how do we just think about that framework? Because this is just unfortunately true. My last bit here is that it's easy for people like Sagar, myself, and Orrin to sit in the, you know, East Coast where, you know, everything is peachy keen. We're just focused on economics. But there's clearly a set of voters in the Republican Party who we do not speak for in any way whatsoever.
Yeah. I think my coda on your last question, my rambling answer on kind of whether things like immigration or trade is leaning a lot on, work by Ian Hinney Lopez. I don't know if you've come across Ian's work. He has done work around how we talk about issues of race and class. And his view is that othering is just kind of par for the course in American politics, and that you're going to those moves are going to get made. It's a question of how. And so he would incorporate a we, not by kind of a set of exclusionary moves towards, you know, immigrants or people within the Latino community, but by looking upwards towards large corporations and kind of making a lot of the US-based multinationals who have, frankly, like, you know, paid their tax lawyers and accountants exorbitant fees to figure out how to evade paying, you know, US coffers, the public back for a lot of the privileges that they've gotten from doing business here. And so there's like a good reason why, even if Congress were in the mood to say compensate the losers of trade back to you know, the base that Trump was able to cobble together, it's not as if we have the public wherewithal to do so mm-hmm. on the back of the kind of the moves that we've seen in globalization over the past 20, 30 years. And that's by and large on account the set of tax policies that we've allowed to happen. You know, some of the stuff is not legal. Some of it's questionable. Some of it is, but all of it needs to stop. And I think just kind of casting a collective gaze on the role that corporations have played in a lot of the pathologies of our economy and in our politics is one way to, you know, have a little bit more of a cohesive we in actually setting the frame of the problem that we want to go after.
No, that's helpful. Quick question that comes to mind is, why isn't democratic socialism the successor to neoliberalism? Because a decent percent of our audience actually comes from the sort of Bernie wing of the party, and they're definitely screaming at me for not asking this question earlier, which is actually Bernie, AOC, Justice Democrats, et cetera, the Sunrise Movement, all these organizations, it's still nascent. They're not politically successful yet outside of major urban regions, but this is clear what the successor is. But the project that you're working on is premised on the idea that we're still shaping around these things. So why am I'm implying that you think this, but why to a certain degree do you all not think democratic socialism is the next successor ideology?
Yeah, I get this a fair amount. my answer, I don't know if it's a good one, but I think my answer is that, you know, those ideas have been around for a while and we are where we are. The piece that I have trouble making clear to people is that these paradigms are only as good as they are useful. They're never really right or wrong in a normative sense. It's not helpful to debate how right neoliberalism is, if that's even a thing that were possible, any more than democratic socialism. The test is of all of these things is how useful they are as a problem-solving matter. And it seems pretty unambiguously the case that given the ideas of democratic socialism have been around as long as neoliberalism has, if not longer, and you haven't seen any kind of uptake and nearly the scale that you would need in order to give them a kind of a demonstration project out of our economy, then it may be not a messaging problem. There may be more more to it than that. And I also think that there's a lot to coming up with these paradigms, the next kind of turn of the intellectual screw, by starting with the changes that have happened in our economy. So the one that I tend to throw at my friends who would identify as democratic socialists is around the role that technology is playing in just changing the kind of DNA of our economy, and in particular, the growing numbers of our economy that are characterized by increasing returns to scale. Things like network effects in, say, social media or things like Amazon. Increasing returns to scale have the property of consolidating, kind of tending towards concentration. Mm-hmm. Initially, economic concentration, but, you know, as we know, it's not as if economic power tends to stay neatly confined to the economic realm. Spills over pretty quickly into political power as one reason for, say, resurrecting a more Brandeisian view of antitrust, which is, you know, a thing that is purple in its politics. You find as many adherents and champions for on the right as you do on the left. But so kind of stringing together like a few stylized facts, if you will, just things that are now true about the economy of 2020 that occasion sort of original thinking, de novo thinking that matches the moment. I would say that is largely, I think, fair and warranted in response to things like structural stagnation. I think that's a pretty good story about what ails our economy that explains why, say, there seem to be new physics controlling monetary policy, fiscal policy, for that matter. Not that we've seen those take hold, but that, you know, it all kind of rose in the direction of having a lot more space, fiscal space and sort of monetary policy space to correct, in the case of monetary policy, right, for 40 years of privileging capital over labor. I think we could now privilege labor over capital and get away with that without seeing inflation of the sort that we would need to be concerned about.
I really love this. And I actually want to end here just by sort of getting you to restate what you really said there, which is the idea of the paradigms, which we honestly, from my show outlining perspective, should have gotten into earlier. Because what I loved about what you just said was neoliberalism, when it worked, was useful. And even New Deal liberalism, for example, because they were ideas that provided a framework for thinking through the world so you could actually have a consensus. So Dwight D. Eisenhower was a Republican, but he was able to govern to the center right, but still within the New Deal liberal consensus. You know, in many ways, this goes to your earlier point about Richard Nixon's interest in UBI. We could add universal healthcare to that as well, too, because at the time, those ideas made sense within that consensus. So it seems to me, if I were to sum up the objective of your project, it's not necessarily to have us right now discover the exact proper tax rate or the exact proper way of approaching every policy problem, but it's to provide the framework, aka the paradigm, for thinking about issues that we're going to confront in the sort of 2020 post-COVID world. So a useful idea on the democratic socialism idea is that democratic socialism and neoliberalism don't provide a useful framework for thinking of Facebook's acquisition of Instagram back in 2012, which is heightened by the networks effect idea you just referenced. So the lack of a framework for thinking about that issue just means that there's a need to come up with a new one. So I was curious what your response to that is as we close out.
You get it.
This is why I ask you the tougher questions, because I'm actually trying to understand. But I think that's the key thing here.
That's exactly right. And so, I mean, I think what you put your finger on is the way in which these paradigms, one key ingredient that allows them to work is not simply the normative claims that they're making, but a set of descriptive claims, really, starting with the world as it seems to be. And so, as a for instance, it seems like one feature of our economy today is the fact of increasing returns across more and more swaths of you know, different sectors. Another feature is a chronic shortfall in demand due to the fact that, like, people like you and me don't want to own the size of homes that our parents did, or aren't that interested in owning a car.
Speak for yourself. I'm sitting in COVID DC. I want the biggest house you've ever imagined right now.
Yeah, I'm saying that with my 1-year-old and 3-year-old, I could probably use a little bit more square footage than San Francisco allows too. But you know, I think there's pretty unambiguously a shortfall in aggregate demand, and that should lend greater comfort for the role in government in fixing that, probably by a set of more ambitious public investments. And we can have, I would love to have a debate about the right ones to make, but at least then we're having a conversation on the right problem rather than, you know, as against a set of libertarian ideas that just don't make sense for the problems that we're up against. I'll end by saying thank you for putting your finger on the necessary piece of describing the world, in addition to a set of normative claims that these paradigms tend to also, you know, have within them. So, I think we need to rethink, say, the relationship between liberty and equality. People like Elizabeth Anderson, probably be a good suggestion for another guest on your show, Danielle Allen, who I just saw launched an exploratory bid for governorship in Massachusetts yesterday. These are philosophers who have been really trying to tell a new story about the relationship between liberty and equality, not as inherently intention, but perhaps thinking about equality as an important precursor to meaningful liberty today, right? So not to kind of diminish the normative content of these intellectual paradigms, but it is to highlight the fact that they need to understand and describe the world, do some sense making for people in the world that people are walking around and experiencing every day. And that has to be, you know, by virtue of understanding what's changed.
Great. Well, Jen, thank you so much. Where can everyone find your work and all those sort of great things?
We just launched this initiative at the Hewlett Foundation, so you can find it on our website, hewlett.org. And I'm somewhat on Twitter, Jennifer M. Harris, but it's spotty at best, probably owing to that 1-year-old and 3-year-old I mentioned. But I love kicking around a lot of these big unwieldy questions. They're important and often don't get the time that they need. So thank you.
Thank you for joining. Hope you enjoyed the episode. As always, send any questions, comments, and thoughts to realignmentpod@gmail.com or subscribe to our Substack at therealignment.substack.com. We really appreciate all of your support, and I am so pumped to get back to you in 2021. See you next year.